Welcome to Bobby Osinski's Inner Circle. I'm Bobby Osinski, and this is a show all about music, music production, and the music business. My guest this week is one of the greatest moving score mixers from the modern era, Alan Meyerson. First of all, I predicted that TikTok would eventually be banned in the United States, and now it looks like that might actually happen. The House of Representatives overwhelmingly passed a measure last Wednesday that gives TikTok parent company ByteDance a choice: either sell TikTok within 6 months or lose access to app stores and web hosting services in the United States. This comes on the heels of a briefing received by Energy and Commerce Committee members from the intelligence community. After the briefing, the nonpartisan committee voted 50-0 for legislation against TikTok to go forward. The bill is now in the hands of the Senate, who may stall passing it until after the election in November. Although many feel that TikTok is causing emotional harm to its many young users, this legislation is all about the threat to national security, since ByteDance is partially owned by the Chinese government. TikTok is already banned in India, and most countries have now banned it on government phones and computers. Just to put it into perspective, Facebook, Instagram, WhatsApp, YouTube, X, and Google, which are all U.S. companies, are all banned in China for exactly the same reasons as TikTok would be banned in the United States. If you have any questions or comments, you can send them to questions@bobbyosinski.com. Also, I'm pleased to announce that my new Musicians AI Handbook is now available. It's packed with information about how AI can help you with new song, lyric, mixing, and mastering ideas, as well as music marketing, to help you get your music out to the audience that you deserve. To get your copy, go to bobbyosinski.com/AI handbook. That's bobbyosinski.com/AI handbook. You can also find it on Amazon and Apple Books. When a piece of recording history comes on the market, we're always tempted to pull out our credit cards, especially when the price seems reasonable. Most of the time, our better judgment kicks in, though, after we gauge the maintenance problems that comes along with the purchase, and cooler heads prevail. That said, sometimes it makes perfect sense to invest in a classic audio device, especially when it's a manufacturer that's doing the buying. Case in point, Universal Audio recently announced the acquisition of a Studio Electronics Corporation tube mixing console that was built especially for Caesar's Palace in Las Vegas in 1966, by original UA founder Bill Putnam Sr. Not only is this a piece of audio history, but it was famous for the fact that it helped mix Las Vegas legends like Frank Sinatra, Judy Garland, Diana Ross, George Burns, Tina Turner, and hundreds more. The console was purchased from Gear Marketplace Reverb and is unique in that it includes 38 UA 1008 tube preamp modules, 21 UA 508 EQ modules on each channel and the echo sends, 3 UA550 filters, 3 UA500 EQs, and 3 Langevin 252 graphic EQs, plus color-coded Langevin faders, blue, yellow, and green, in 3 banks of 6. This purchase makes sense for Universal Audio not only because the company's founder designed it, but it can now be used for research that may result in new products. Even if nothing ever comes of it, UA feels like the right fit for the Caesars console, almost like it's finally coming home. My guest this week is engineer Alan Meyerson, who many believe is a top-scoring mixer in film today. With more than 200 credits, Alan has worked with leading film score composers like James Newton Howard, John Powell, Harry Gregson-Williams, and Danny Elfman, and has a particularly long-standing working relationship with the great Hans Zimmer that continues to this day. Alan's credits as a scoring mixer includes blockbuster movies like Man of Steel, Iron Man, the Pirates of the Caribbean series, Sherlock Holmes, A Game of Shadows, Inception, The Dark Knight, Kung Fu Panda 1 and 2, Despicable Me 1 and 2, The Last Samurai, Gladiator, and Hannibal. In addition to this, he also has a number of music mixing credits that include Brian Ferry, New Order, Etta James, and OMD. During our interview, Alan told me about being a part of the first wave of dance music, making the transition to film work, his approach to orchestral recording, why he isn't into vintage microphones, how he tailors his reverbs, dealing with 750 tracks of orchestra, his adventures at Abbey Road, and much more. I spoke with Alan from a studio in Los Angeles. I want to go back to the beginning of when you started, because I've read a little bit about this, and you have a very interesting history.
Yeah.
You started as a trumpet player.
Well, I started as a trumpet owner. And I thought I was a player, and very, very quickly when I got into college, a level where I was with other people my age that were devoted to playing their instruments, I realized that I didn't really have what it took. I didn't have the practice discipline to get to where they were, and I don't think I had the talent. And, you know, when I was in high school with guys like Marcus Miller, and I just thought, well, the super guys are super, and I'll just get there. And then when I got to college, I realized that I wasn't going to get there. And so I was a little despondent. All I had ever thought of in my life was being a musician. You know, I wanted to play in the New York Philharmonic. I thought that all I needed to do was get from point A to point H, and I could play in the New York Philharmonic. But it turns out it wasn't quite as easy as that. So I've told the story before, roaming around at Brooklyn College, sort of lost and not sure what I wanted to do. I heard music, and I went to the music and turned right, and there was a sound studio with this guy named Frank. And he was in there editing or something like that. And then there was this little tiny like ISO booth or control room with an unwired, I remember it was a Roger Mayer console, but it's the first console I ever saw in my life. So I didn't exactly know what it was. And then like a little recording space in an office and stuff like that. And I, you know, asked him, you know, what's going on here. He told me that this is, they support both theaters at Brooklyn College, Whitman and Gershwin, and they do recordings, and they edit, you know, student performances and stuff like that. And would I be interested in maybe spending time there and doing a sort of an internship? I don't think they even called it internships in those days, you know? And I came in, and it was incredible, because like immediately the first thing I learned how to do was solder, how to really neatly make a patch bay, and like how to, you know, put stress relief on cables and dress them properly and make sure you don't have cold solder joints and things like this, you know, all this basic stuff that no one knows anymore, you know, that, but I learned how to do all that. And I also actually got pretty good at editing, because, you know, the stuff you were editing were student performances, and in a way they're a little bit harder to edit than professional stuff. And, you know, I learned how to scrub a piece of audio and find the spot and mark it. Or Frank, he didn't even bother marking it. He just put his thumbnail there and pulled it. But I actually didn't do that. And it was a great experience. And while I was there, we had this piano tuner who would come to Brooklyn College and tune the piano. They were beautiful theaters. I mean, we did a lot of first line kind of Brooklyn stuff where, you know, like we had Dizzy Gillespie's 60th birthday there, and, you know, the Joffrey would come and do performances there and stuff like that. So I got to, you know, stagehand for all that stuff and get involved in just sort of, you know, the backstage life, you know, and I really liked it a lot. So I met this guy, Peter. And he was an old Irish piano tuner. And he told me that one of his clients, this guy named Jerry Ragavoy, who I later went on to find out was this Philadelphia songwriter who wrote Time Is On My Side and Cry Baby and Get It While You Can and all that stuff, was building a new studio. And he thinks that they might be looking for people. So I called him, and they offered me an interview at 1 o'clock on a certain day. And I showed up at 10 for my 1 o'clock interview. And he said, "What, isn't your interview this afternoon?" I said, "Yeah, I think it's 1 o'clock." He goes, "Okay, well, leave and come back at 1 o'clock. So I roamed around Times Square for 3 hours. Because, you know, I wasn't going to go back to Brooklyn, which is where I was living. And I came back at one, and he just immediately gave me the job, because he figured if anyone was, you know, that hungry to get the job, then he probably wanted it. And I was amazed that I was making $3.50 an hour. Great stuff.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
And somehow or other, I lived on that, you know, with a bit of a drug problem too. So I'm not quite sure how I pulled that off. But I, you know, starting in that world, commercial music is, I mean, learning from the ground up is incredible, because the great thing about that was every single day you did something from A to Z, from setting up mics to shipping deliverables. And so I had to learn how to, well, first I had to learn how to come in at 6 a.m. and make sure the bathroom was clean and get the coffee going and mop the floors a little bit and vacuum and then set up the session, you know, and we had an engineer there named Gary Chester, who to this day, I worship him. I think that, you know, he was just such a, he was a wonderful guy. He was, I mean, we were, it was the late 70s. So when I say wonderful, everyone was a little crazy. So, you know, he was just a good kind of crazy. And I really learned so much from him. It was incredible. And I saw he could do things so fast and make it sound so good. And especially would make clients very, very comfortable and happy. So that was one of his, you know, great skills, his superpowers was everyone just felt so taken care of, you know, and I learned, you know, from my later career that that's such a huge part of this job is to make sure that people have total confidence in what's happening. And that really came in handy when I started working on major motion pictures and stuff like that, even in the record business. Although, you know, when I was in, so not to go ahead too quickly, but, and not to linger either. So I got a job there. I was there for 2 years. I had this opportunity to go to Belgium to work as an engineer in this small little countryside would be the nicest way you could think of it. It was in the middle of nowhere, right near where Napoleon, right near Waterloo. So, and I worked at the studio, but what was amazing was the reason they had reached out to me or come to me is we had a session. This Belgian producer wanted to do this session in Manhattan on July 4th and they couldn't get anything. So Jerry got the booking and he was looking for an engineer. And I said, look, I'll do it. And he's like, yeah, why not? You do it. And it was, I mean, I had never done a session before. So none that anyone was paying for. I had my friends come in and recorded bands and stuff. So I did the session. It went well. And he liked me and asked me if I'd like to come live in Belgium for a while. And I, you know, figured, well, I had to ask my parents. I was only 19. And I ended up going there and it was tough. You know, I wasn't quite ready to be on my own. I wasn't emotionally sort of stable enough to do that. And I found my little American spots because I wasn't comfortable with language and all that. And I took hostage of this woman, you know, who had an apartment and I stayed with her. I don't think she knew what hit her. You know, she got rid of me as soon as she could. And I still remember her name though. It was Ijon. So I did that. And I eventually sort of wore out my welcome a little bit. I don't think I was quite what they expected, you know? And I ended up coming back and tried to go back to Counterpoint. And I came back for a while and Jerry wasn't interested and he fired me, but he helped me get a job in a voiceover studio. So I was doing voiceovers for a while. But the cool thing was, again, working with people, getting stuff done, starting in the morning, finishing at night, working on a Neve console, working on an MCI console. And I did that for a while until one of these independent engineers I'd worked with, this woman, Leanne Unger, who now teaches at Berkeley engineering, she asked me if I wanted to come freelance assist for her at RCA Studios in New York on 44th Street, which was this phenomenal.
Yeah, studio. Wow.
It had motorized ceiling, go up and down, you know. And I did this Peter Chris record as an assistant engineer and so on and so on. And I ended up at the Hit Factory and I was there during the John Lennon era. And then I was hired away by Phil Ramone's old studio, A&R Recording.
Mm-hmm.
And because I had jingle skills and I also was developing a decent reputation as a solid assistant and someone who could cover a session if necessary and stuff like that. So I went there and unfortunately that's when sort of my personal issues came to a head. And I as many people did at that time, I struggled with cocaine abuse and sort of just like losing track of my life. And I got fired from that job. I figured that I was unemployable at that point. And one of the clients I worked with that came to A&R called me up like a day later, or at least in my memory, it's a day later, and said, listen, you know, we did those sessions in there with this engineer, but I kind of saw who was doing the work and would you like to mix some stuff for us? So I got hired to mix this Cadillac campaign. And it's probably 1980, and $15 an hour. I mean, my God.
Yeah, there you go. Big money. Yeah.
$15 an hour. Are you kidding? And I did that and it went well. And I built up a career doing jingles. And then one of the jingle clients also was working on records. So he brought me and had me engineer a session in the studio called Shakedown Sound, which was owned by this guy, Arthur Baker.
Mm-hmm.
And I ended up working there. So I was the night guy. Andy Wallace was the day guy. And I was the night guy. And I was became sort of part of the first wave. You know, I was doing records, you know, dance records when dance records were just being invented and stuff like that. It was pretty crazy. It was a lot of fun. You know, in that period of time, I got sober. So now I didn't have, you know, I could like show up and be good all day. And that actually became a career advantage because there weren't that many sober yeah, right. years. So I, you know, having the ability to not, you know, just be out of my mind would turned out to work to my advantage. And I worked with Arthur for a while and I met the guy who owned Tommy Boy Records and his president, this woman, Monica Lynch. And they got me this 12-inch remix for Brian Ferry. And I did this mix and he liked it and asked me to remix the album for the third time. This album had been mixed by two other people. And I mixed it and that came out and people liked it. And I started getting cred as a record mixer. So, you know, I got to do New Order and I got to do Orchestral Maneuvers in the Dark. And at this point, I was working on both coasts. And I decided, well, if I'm going to work on both coasts, why don't I live near the beach and look at women in bikinis instead of, you know, living above a pizza place. So I moved out to LA and pursued the record career that I wanted. I actually wanted to be a producer. In the style of Phil Ramone or Alex Satkin or any of the guys that were engineer producers. But that era was kind of over. You know, became the time of writer producers that had a little setup in their house and a keyboard and could play a part and help them figure out their bridge and stuff. And I didn't have any of those skills. So I got sort of, because of that, I got thrown into hip hop, mixing hip hop stuff. And it wasn't my world, you know, and I was very uncomfortable. And I didn't feel like I was as good as, you know, I was having to compare myself to the Lord Algies and Clear Mountain and Brower and all that. And I just didn't feel like I was to their level, even though I was getting work pretty much at that level. And my interest waned. And as it happens, when you're no longer interested, people stop coming. So I took a break. I was doing some career deciding and I was going to maybe leave the business and go to chiropractic college. Through another long, uninteresting story, I met the people that ran Hans's studio and, I ended up getting invited to visit and I covered a session, which went well. And then, they asked me to do a session with Hans and I did this percussion session with Hans right at the end of Lion King. I had already worked for them. I just had never met Hans. I was helping out with the foreign language versions of the original Lion King. And that was going great. They were loving my mixes and all that stuff. And so I got thrown into a percussion session for this movie, Renaissance Man, with Hans and Penny Marshall, the great director, the great Brooklynite. Being from Brooklyn, she immediately felt me, you know? And musically, I was in my wheelhouse. You know, I sort of, you know, I grew up a classical musician. So, you know, I was never that comfortable with lead vocal, bass, drums, and guitar. It wasn't my language. But all of a sudden, I'm working on orchestral music. I'm working on hybrid orchestral music. So now all my dance record skills are being taken into account. So I'm starting to be able to, you know, have these multiple skill sets that are, you know, happen to find a person like Hans Zimmer who really appreciated all that stuff. So he asked me to do that entire album and that movie, Renaissance Man. And that was 3 months, and that 3 months has now lasted 30 years. And you know, Hans has moved to London. And I don't do every project with him anymore. I still have a great relationship with him. I did three projects with him last year, so I guess I don't know what I'm talking about. I did Dune, I did The Creator, and I did Big SpongeBob. But I built up a clientele and I built up my own sort of business. And now I have a studio there at Remote Control Productions. I have an Atmos room and I have this room at home, which I put up during the pandemic to sort of, and this room has done just so well, it's ridiculous. I mean, most of the work I do here, I've been busy, you know, I've stayed busy since the mid 80s for the most part, except for that period of time where I was a little lost. So, you know, do about 10 movies a year now.
Well, just to show you sometimes the 6 degree of separation, I knew Jerry Ragavoy a little bit. I used to work for AMEC, the console company.
Of course, yeah.
And Jerry wanted to buy one. And we had a lot of conversations and it went back and forth. And I don't remember if he bought one or not, to be honest. I think he did. I think he
What year was it?
Well, this would have been in early 80s. So
no, so I can tell you he didn't. Because he had a Trident Series 80, and then he sold that for a Quad 8 Coronado.
Okay, I thought he bought a 2500, but maybe not. It's a long time ago. So
maybe he did. Maybe for a different studio. Maybe. Yeah. But yeah, no, that's great. Jerry was a character.
Yeah. And I didn't know that he did, he was in Janis Joplin's band as well.
He wasn't. He just wrote the song.
Oh, I thought he was in the band too.
No, he wrote Cry Baby and Get It While You Can. And but he wrote Cry Baby like a doo-wop song. It was all in 6/8. Cry Baby.
Yeah.
Cry Baby. And then she did that. And the same with Time Is On My Side. You know, exactly the same sort of doo-wop-y street musician 6/8 feel. But he was a good guy. He's, you know, he saw, and as many people did, when I worked at the Hit Factory, at Germano, very much just the same way. You know, he saw the young assistants as sort of, you know, something slightly less valuable than a microphone.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah, I get it. That was the day. So, yeah.
Those were the days. But I you know, look, I when I look at, you know, people coming up today, and I see what their path is and how hard it is for them to like understand what the experience of, you know, working with people and putting up my, you know, I was working with the best musicians in the world when I was 19 because we were doing jingles. They didn't mess around. You'd have Steve Gadd on drums. You'd have Will Lee on bass. You'd have the Blood, Sweat, and Tears horn section. You'd have this guy, Harry Lukowski, who played with Sinatra. It was the best of the best of the best because there was no time for them to hire not the best. So that was, you know, Michael Brecker became one of my dearest friends because he really helped my road to sobriety because he had, you know, he also got sober about the same time. And you know, just to go out in the room and the people know your name and everything like that, it was just fantastic.
I didn't do many of those kind of sessions, many jingles, but they were exhilarating, the ones that I did do, because it was so fast and you had to get it right.
And it had to be an incredibly, it has to be perfect.
Yeah.
I mean, they did not suck. I mean, they weren't second rate music. That were top rate music done for a specific purpose. And the timings had to be perfect. All the tempos had to be worked out because you had to hit certain moments. And this would be long before a computer. They had this thing called the Clickbook.
Yes, I remember.
Or you know this, but to your audience, there was this thing called the Clickbook. It was about twice the thickness of your Bible, if you're so inclined. And in there is every tempo and every division of every time signature that will hit every hit. And you had to go in there with like a slide rule and figure out what tempo you could do this to there and then this to there and this to there. And they did it. I mean, it was just incredible. The talented, you know, I mean, people like Joey Levine, who you know, was also, he had a band called 1910 Fruit Gum Company.
Yeah.
They, you know, these guys did, you know, like Tom Dawes wrote, We're American Airlines Doing What We Do Best. And all these things. It was just a lot of fun. It was a lot of work, but I didn't really notice the work. I mean, I was young enough that, and I had no life. I mean, that was it.
I mean,
who would have a life when you could do all that? You know, and, you know, it wasn't like I had a car and I was living out in Burbank. Everything, I was taking a train everywhere and Midtown in the 70s, leaving work at 3 a.m, going to the D train, the RR to the D. You know, you're lucky you made it home sometimes.
Yeah, right.
It was not the Times Square that you see today.
Yeah,
you know,
right.
No, the 42nd Street did not have the Lion King playing on it. It might have had something else with the word lion
in
it.
That's right.
Or the word king, but not Lion King.
Okay, let's jump up to, you started to do movies. You have a lot of music experience at this point. So what were the adjustments that you had to make?
Well, I mean, first of all, that the most important adjustment was the music was not an end to itself. It was the means to an end of a larger piece of creative work. So, you know, your job not only was to make the music sound great, but to make sure that it's not, and I don't mean arrangement wise because that's the composer, but make sure that your mix doesn't get in the way of dialogue. And it, you know, you have to really be aware of where your low end is, because you're going to have sound effects with massive low end. And so that kind of thing. And then the scale, you know, it's, you know, now I went from, you know, when I was in New York doing jingles, I, you know, you'd have 18 string players, 8 brass players, 6 singers. Now I have 70 string players, you know, 16 brass players, 12 woodwinds, you know, just I'm doing 100 piece sessions all the time. Now film work, most of the time we split it up, but sometimes we don't, you know, like when I work with James Newton Howard, we record everyone together. And believe it or not, I just did a video game, this Jedi Survivor, where we recorded everything together at Abbey Road, all in the room at the same time. And with no pre-record, you know, wow. It was just a performance. So you have to learn how to scale up. And I found that to be actually, in a strange way, easier than it is to work, you know, in a more record-oriented thing for me, because you weren't dealing with personalities in the same way. You were part of this machine. And if you do your job right, with humor and with care, and make sure that everyone is taken care of and everyone, you know, feels loved and taken care of, then, you know, you could thrive. You know, there was less bullshit, honestly. And I'm not saying there's no bullshit. There's tons of bullshit, but it's a different kind of bullshit. You know, when you work, people paid you, you know.
Yeah.
In the record business, you never knew if you were going to get paid.
Yeah, right. Or how long it will take.
I did this record once where I finished the record. I got a call from the A&R person saying, we love your mixes. We really think they're great. Unfortunately, we're not going to release the album and we're not going to pay you. And you can sue us if you want, but if you sue us, then you'll never work with anyone from our company again, or anyone that knows anyone from our company again. So it's up to you. And we're sorry. We know this sucks, but that's just the way it is.
Yeah.
What do you do about that? You know, you never get that, you know, in the film world. So those are differences. And you know, the instrumental world is so different, you know, in terms of colors and the textures. You know, record business, you have to go by certain rules. You have to, you know, depending on what's popular at the time, the beat had to have a certain quality to it. The singer had to have a certain delay on it. The background vocals had to have a certain, you know, it didn't in those days exist in film. It actually got more like that later on when people like Hans started writing music that was so iconic. And John Williams, yes, but you couldn't easily do John Williams. But, you know, Newton Howard and stuff like that. And then they'd be like, we want it to sound like Gladiator. We want it to sound like Thin Red Line. We want it to sound like The Rock. We want it to sound like Dark Knight, you know? So it sort of pushes and pulls. But for me, it's much more interesting.
Did you start, were you mixing soundtracks before you recorded them?
Well, good question. I think I probably mixed Speed and Renaissance Man and someone else recorded it. And then after that, I started recording it. But I think the first one I recorded from the beginning to the end and mixed was The Rock. It all becomes blurry.
Sure, sure. But here we go, because recording an orchestra is so different than recording pop music or hip hop or anything like that that you were doing, even doing jingles. It's way different. So how did you deal with that then, like the first time going in?
You know, I went to a couple of sessions for, you know, Sean Murphy was gracious enough to let me sit in on a session. Dennis Sands was gracious enough to let me sit in on a session. When I had to do my first session, I had good mic technique from, you know, my drum sounds were good. I was a good engineer.
Mm-hmm.
And scaling it up, I just sort of, you know, there are certain fundamental rules with orchestral music that if you follow them, you'll be okay. You know, basically a deca tree and a couple of spots and you're good. It's when you get experimental and stuff that you can, you know, sort of lose your oars. So I sort of followed that way. And then when I got comfortable in my career and started not really worrying that, you know, what I'm doing sounds like anyone else anymore, then I started expanding on my palette a little bit and collecting microphones and stuff, not vintage microphones. I'm not I don't really own any vintage. I had used to own vintage microphones. I sold them all because the reliability factor is just too, and there's too many good versions of vintage microphones now that can get you through. So I started really getting into developing my own sound, and I'm still working on that. I mean, I did something new on this movie I'm doing now, Despicable Me 4, on the brass, that I think is, everyone was like, Jesus, you know, and then you think, oh my God, why haven't I been doing this for the last 20 years? And it's something simple that I've done before, but for some reason now I got it a little bit more tweaked or balanced in the right way. And I just was able to really increase the power of this brass section. Yeah, big brass section, but just by adding a pair of Bloomline, you know, but not everyone, you know, nowadays, most people, when they use Bloomline, they're grabbing a ribbon mic that's a built stereo mic and they put it up. But I bought three of the Neumann 47Vs that they came out with last year. And I used those to do my Bloomline, and had, instead of putting the brass behind the trombones, which is pretty much the standard, and then the French horns on the other side, I put the trumpets in the center. Now, I've done that a million times in the past, but for some reason, this time, whatever mics I was using, it all just worked out. And you know, my client was sort of like, you know, is this real? Is this, you know, why does this sound so good? You know, well, it's a good studio with good microphones and great players and really, really well-written music. It should sound good.
So you're still using a Decca-Tree. Are you using M50s on?
I am using M50s. I also have Flea 50s, but when I'm at Abbey Road, I use M50s. I'm very, very happy with my Flea 50s. I've compared them to M50s, and I really, if I'm not told which one is which, I have a 50-50 shot of picking my Fleas or Neumann M50s. It's not like one of them comes out with a water stamp, Neumann, this is real, and the other one comes out and says imitation. It doesn't. They're very, very good. And I know the Wonders are also very good. You know, there are 50s, you know, small capsule, Perspec, severe mounted microphones out there.
Yeah, there's a lot of really good clones these days that are every bit as good as the vintage ones.
Right. I mean, I'm a big Flea supporter. I have like 14 of their mics. I have three of their 47s. I have two of their C12s. I have a couple of 49. I'm a big 49 guy. So I bought the 349Vs. I have four M149s. I have two original M49s. And then I have three of the Flea 49s also. So, you know, if you look at the low side of my orchestral recordings, brass or strings, you're going to see a lot of 49s there.
You are a collector.
I'm not a collector. I'm a user. I'm a collector that only collects things that I can use.
Yeah, yeah.
The only mic I have that I don't use is this beautiful Royer that is in gunmetal that was given to me as a gift by Royer on the 25th anniversary of this mic, because I was one of the first people to put that mic up and got noticed because I used them as my string mics on Thin Red Line. And he said, I sold a lot of mics for them. So Roy is a very, you know, I'm very good friends with them. They support me and I beta test for them. I actually bought their prototypes for the tube mics. The ones I have were four of the seven original prototypes that they're slightly different than the ones that are now available to be purchased. And they're not really that good on guitars, but they are amazing on woodwinds and on trumpets and stuff like that.
Let's come back for a second to mixing. So it seems to me that you're very particular about reverb and how you use it.
Right.
Is this something you developed, or is this something that you always did?
You know, honestly, it was something I got wrong before I got right. And I always go back, you know, it's funny, I don't remember all the good stuff I did, but I do remember a lot of the bad stuff I did. And I remember doing this mix 37 years ago. And I thought it sounded great. And then someone listened to it, goes, it sounds like it's underwater. And I realized that I spent so much time focusing on the reverbs that everything had reverb on it. It was just, and so because of that, I went, okay, I can't do that. And I got much more particular about the way I use reverb, especially in film music, but even in records. You know, when I did an album for Moby a couple of years ago, and you know, I had to get very, very crafty about how to use reverb. But yeah, I spend quite a bit of time tailoring the reverb, making sure that the clarity stays. And, you know, most of the time I want the reverb to be felt but not heard, but every now and then I want the reverb to be heard, you know? So I have, like, on my orchestra, I have three or four different reverbs. And what I do is I put them in Pro Tools. It's all one send from my whatever the orchestra is. And it goes to three different auxes with three different reverbs, so I can automate them. So I can have a long, a medium, or a short and a medium and an effect one, say. So, you know, if there's short strings playing busy stuff, the long reverb is going to get very blurry. I can automate down that and get creative with it. And that's part of my basic setup. Is in my layouts is, you know, when I do, like this movie I'm now doing, Despicable Me, we have like 20 passes of orchestral elements. We have like 12 possible passes of strings and woodwinds, 6 possible passes of brass, and then all the percussion. So each one of those will be a layout, and on it will be all the things in that layout, you know, my master fader, all the rooms on a master, all the spot mics on a master, and then 3 reverb sends that I can automate and stuff like that. And it becomes very, very fast. I don't really think about the technology when I'm mixing that much. I just make sure it gets set up and gets set up solidly. And so I get very detailed about reverbs. I get very detailed about delays. I do all that. But when I was trying to be a record producer, I was pretty detailed about reverbs and delays too. And I was pretty avant-garde. I think that hurt my career more than helping it.
Really?
You know, I was really trying to create a sound.
Yeah.
And I don't think my sound got, you know, purchased.
Okay. So when you're doing a mix, is it automatically 5-1 or is it automatically Atmos?
No, it's not even, well, first of all, for film release, usually the music, and I know Jason covered this too, usually the music person is asked not to deliver Atmos. So we deliver either 5-1 or 7-1, and then they, on the dub stage, they can create the Atmos from that. The reason being is, you know, if we deliver Atmos, then we have to deliver an ADM file, and then they have to tie up their objects and stuff like that. And also they can't make any, and if not, I bake it into a print. And then they can't control or change. And then once you put final dialogue and sound effects in there, it's different. So I don't very often, unless specifically asked to do an Atmos film music mix, I don't. But I do Atmos soundtrack albums and do that. But for the most part, we deliver 7-1 nowadays. I still get asked for 5-1 sometimes. Believe it or not, I have clients that work in quad, and they only want me to send quad stems, which makes sense because if it's all pre-recorded material, there isn't really need to use the center channel.
Yeah, right.
Here's the center channel for dialogue and stuff like that. And every now and then you get someone that wants it to be stereo.
Well, okay. When you do that, is that less fun for you?
Oh, it's all a challenge. I look at it all as I come in, it's like, okay, today I get to mix in stereo, you know, or yes, today I get to mix Atmos and stuff. I just sort of embrace whatever it is. What I don't like is what gets frustrating is when they're not getting what they want. They don't know how to get me there, you know? And I think that's every engineer's sort of curse.
Yeah. I can remember the engineers, the generation before us, the Bruce Woodins and Al Schmidt and Ken Scott. And they would all say about mono mixes, about how that was more fun. And it was so much more difficult because when you got it to sound great in mono, then it would sound great in stereo without having to work
right.
too hard.
So that doesn't work that well in film because of the way that low end is used in film music. But I when I'm doing a record, I still check it in mono. I have a set of Oratones over there. I actually do my vocal balances on those, and I make sure my rhythm section sounds good in mono and everything like that for the most part. You know, if it's not a densely... It's hard with dense records. You know, it's really hard to really get it that perfect down in mono. If you have multiple point sources for your microphones and stuff, it's challenging. Stereo is much, much easier. And then obviously, as you expand out into immersive and you're not limited by, you know, like your hands on a steering wheel at 10 and 2, but now you could have 9 and 3 or everything, you know, somewhat around, although you don't really want to put material in the back. That's primary material for most scores. It I find that I need less compression when I work in the wider my soundscape is, the less compression I need, the less EQ I need, you know, the less sort of boost EQ I need. It doesn't really change my cutting EQs, but my boosting EQs, it changes.
You know, one of the funny things that I've experienced in immersive, especially listening to classic records that are being redone in immersive, that they don't work in immersive as well as they did in stereo. But yet there are some genres of music that immersive is made for. For instance, dance music seems to work really well in immersive, and orchestral seems like it was made for that.
Right. And by the way, you know, like, come listen to Bob Clearmountain's remixes of Roxy Music's Avalon.
Well,
and it might change your opinion about
No, I've heard some of Bob's mixes, and Bob has a unique touch that he can make it work, but he's rare.
Yes, I know. And I've been actually presenting mixes I've done in immersive, because when you talk about that, Bob and I sort of represent the yin and the yang of the way immersive is perceived. The way I look at immersive is I want to be in this experience, and I don't, it's not, I'm not trying to put you in the sixth row. You know, I'm not a classical music engineer, but I'm also not trying to trick you with shit moving around all over the place. I just want you to have this experience that you couldn't have in any other place. And actually, these immersive mixes I've done on this video project, Jedi Survivor, which, by the way, we won the Grammy for Best Interactive Soundtrack. And I, fortunately, was a producer, so got myself one of them. But the immersive mixes, you know, it's funny, for the game, we couldn't mix in Atmos because they didn't have enough of DSP data stream to be able to handle the extra four channels.
Oh, yeah.
It delivered in 7.1, and that became the standard for the game. So this was the first time I was able, you know, doing an immersive version of it as an OST, was the first time I was ever able to play with it. And it just was, it's fantastic. Because I learned really how to mix. I mean, I mixed some Atmos, like I did Lion King in Atmos, the later one, the one that happened a few years ago. And I did this Ang Lee movie in Atmos and a couple of others. But the place I really learned how to find my way was when I started doing movies. I had this friend, Ron Bartlett. He's a phenomenal re-recording mixer. I've done Dune with him. I've done 50 movies with him. I've done, so we just did Marley and all that. He's, in my opinion, he's one of the five top guys in that world. And they have an immersive setup that they use on a dub stage that's realized slightly differently. And for me, with orchestral music or for film score of any variety, not even orchestral, it could be sort of synth driven stuff too. It works really, really great. So I started it. I actually begged him to lend me his template, and I sort of built a template off of his template and found myself an environment that actually works really well for me. And it's basically, you know, I'm not looking at a bed and objects as much as I'm looking at three steps. So the first step is made by the bed and a 0.2. And then the next step is using objects. You raise it up and then tiny bit back. And then the next step, you raise it up more and a tiny bit back. And so on and so forth. And by doing that, you can get subtle differences in height that, like, for example, on Lion King, I wanted, because the low woodwinds represented Scar, the baddie, right?
Yeah.
So I wanted that to be a little scary and like there was a big shadow behind them. So I had them raised up above the orchestra a little bit. Yes, we're still here, but we're sitting. It's like a Wagner, you know, performance where they have French horns sitting up 6 feet or in the, you know, choir or in the, you know, side, you know what I mean?
Yeah. Right.
And so you can get into sort of that kind of staging and as long as you don't overdo it, you know, I have this thing I call, all the people I've taught will tell you certain things that, you know, what are the Meyerson rules? The 20% rule. You know, is you do something that you think sounds amazing and then you back it off 20%. Because we always, or at least I always go too far. And that goes back to mixing that sounds like it's underwater. You know, it's like everything, if you soloed any one thing I did, it sounded amazing, right? But then you put it all together and it's just like, whoa. So I learned that to be very specific, very careful with my reverbs, very careful with my pannings and positionings, really thinking through what's on this side, what's on that side, you know, where's the energy? It's a very visceral thing for me, mixing.
But there's so much of mixing that's sort of like that, where just about the time you begin to hear it, that's enough. And that's hard to learn.
And sometimes just by the time you begin to hear it, it's too much.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah.
You know, I mean, there are certain things that are not meant to be heard, but they're meant to be, to do a job.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah, yeah.
Some certain times you get a pulsy thing, like a pulsy synth, and all it's there to do is to drive, you know, just to sort of push the bus along. They're like the wheels on a tank, you know, just sort of get, oh, I like that. I like that analogy. So yes. And then sometimes it's the opposite. Sometimes what you think is loud enough isn't loud enough. And look at any lead vocal on any record mix since 2010, you know,
yeah, right.
It's screaming loud.
Yeah. You know, you mentioned synths before. It seems like you're dealing, except for synthesizers, like you're dealing with mostly real instruments, acoustic instruments.
No, not necessarily. I mean, yes, but they are put into a world where it's heavily combined. You know, Hans is a big Zebra lover. And so there's tons of Zebra sounds in his stuff. And, you know, my version of a perfect low end for a film is a combination of orchestral low end and some sort of synth driven low end. I'm not afraid to process stuff. I am not afraid to take a live performance and make it sound like something else entirely. I'm into that. But a lot of times, like the project I'm about to start mixing on Monday, I can tell you because of my experience with this composer, my synth master is going to be 400 plus tracks before I add my first orchestra pass. And then I'm going to have 750 tracks of orchestra. But I don't think of it like that. You know, it's all about pre-mixing and micro and you know, macro managing and then micromanaging, you know. So for me, 12 passes, even if they're 40 mics a pass, it's a pass. So once I get my balance inside, I don't go back inside unless I need to move the violas up a little bit. And I just treat the whole thing as a single sound. So I just simplify.
And just some tech for a second. So, okay, if you have that many tracks, are you running off of one computer?
I am now.
And what are you running off of?
I'm running off of one of the new Mac studios with running Pro Tools Ultimate with, and it gives me 2000 tracks at 48K. So I'm even printing into the same computer. You know, I don't print all the time. I do some offline printing when I'm not using any outboard reverb or anything like that. But a lot of times I'll commit files, but sometimes I print when it's something that is really not dense and I have the space and it's really musical. I prefer to print because reverbs will render differently when you do them offline. And I need to hear exactly what I'm delivering. I have this real need for that. Now, there are times I can't, you know, where it's just too big. But so then I don't, but I do when I can.
Okay. Are you using much outboard gear?
I'm not really using any anymore. I have 10 Bricastes. So I like Bricastes and I use the Bricastes as one of my main orchestral percussion reverbs. But even that I'm moving away from a little bit at the moment, just to have the portability and you know, be able to open it up in other places. And then in terms of the only other place I really use outboard gear is on my analog soundtrack chain. I have a Manly Varimu and Ear 825 and a Smart C1. And that's it. And other than that, I own a lot of outboard gear. I'm not selling it. You know, I love it. I have a lot of massive passives. You know, they were on my massive passives were EQ'd the orchestra on Gladiator. Why would I sell them? You know, I still have the Gladiator speakers in the closet, you know.
Well, hey, if you have room, why not?
Yeah. But I own 120 microphones and you know, a pretty large variety of preamps and stuff like that. Three sets, full surround sets of speakers. I have two sets of ATCs, one with hundreds at remote control, one with 50s at home. And then I have B&W 802s that are my orchestral recording speakers. And I just roll them out. They have an amp built into the road case and they plug and play. So I bring them to all my stages with me. So that's where my money gets spent.
When you're recording, what preamps are you using out of curiosity?
You know, for the meat and potato stuff, I'm using Graces. And you, for the very, very simple reason that I have a remote control with me in the control room and I leave them out there and everything, you know, I can have 64 of them in a box right in front of me. So I own 40. And then like at Warner Brothers, they own 16. So we have 56 there. And I tend to use those a lot. For my main mics right now, I'm using this Forcell preamp, Fred Forcell, yeah. Which is sort of a JFET preamp that I actually had the prototypes for years and one of them died. And I said to him, can you fix it? He goes, I can, but would you maybe like take a leap of faith and say that maybe in the last 20 years I've improved? He says, let me send you my new preamps. If you don't like them, send them back. If you like them, send me the old ones back and I'll charge you a little bit of money. So I did, and I kept them. They're great. And then I have a rack of Neves 1066s, and I have 8 channels of the Manly Force preamps. Then I have some of the AEA ribbon mic preamps that I put right next to them. And when I use like a passive ribbon mic, like a 4038, a Kohl's 4038, I just put the preamp right next to it. So, and then I have others too. I just can't remember.
Yeah, right. Well, I'm just curious because, you know, that can be contentious. People getting their camps, you know, what they like and they insist on using all the time. But it sounds like you'll use whatever works.
And on this project, I used the console a lot because there was a lot of stuff that was going to move around. And, you know, the main V-Series preamps on the later boards, they sound pretty good, you know, and I did a drum kit through it. It sounded great, you know, and with percussion, I like to use them because I like being able to control the output level because sometimes, if they're playing a shaker, then I want to crank it up a little bit. If they're playing, a Tyco, then I want to crank it down a little bit. And it's nice to have that right in front of you, old school, like we did when we were kids.
Yeah,
you
know? Right. Okay, what do you think is changing in the business, in your business? And are there particular trends that you're seeing?
Well, yeah, I mean, this trend for everything getting more powerful and smaller, and then through that, the quality of the plugins are getting astronomically better than they were, to the point where, you know, there's stuff I can imagine and do with plugins that I could never do with an analog gear. You know, I stopped thinking of it as a replacement and just started getting creative with it. I think things are getting fast. I think that AI is going to be a part of this conversation pretty soon. Like you and I will be having this conversation in 3 years talking about, you know, track splitting and stuff like that. So I think that computational power increasing at the scale that it is changing the business.
I wrote a book on AI for music production.
I know you did.
And the interesting part was I went through about 200 different AI platforms and plugins and whatever. It was really difficult, to be honest with you, to go through that many and just, you know, figure out the differences.
I actually listened to one of your podcasts today about AI with the Moises AI.
Oh yeah, right. But what was interesting is there's AI for audio, but it's really limited because there's only a few companies that do it. It's Isotope, it's Sonable, it's Focusrite.
Well, yes, but you've got to look away from that and go look at Peter Jackson and what he's doing, what he did with the Beatles stuff. And you know, that technology is going to find its way into, you know, again, right now he needs the biggest computers in the world to do that, but pretty soon you'll be able to do it on your Apple Watch, you know, so... So as all of that stuff trickles down into the, you know, daily usage for music people or video people or stuff like that, we'll start seeing the fruits of that. Unfortunately, we'll also, I think long before we see the fruits, we're going to see the other side of the poison.
This
is a political conversation.
That's coming, right. But, we already do have great separation technology this. And noise reduction technology has gotten so good.
We have okay separation technology. We don't have great separation technology.
Well, it's not Peter Jackson level. Yes, I agree.
But I mean, if I put an orchestra into a Melodyne and I want to change the viola note a single step down inside of an environment where it's recorded in a large space, that's when it starts showing you its dirty underwear.
Yeah, all right. Okay. I'm with you there.
Right. So, you know, that Peter Jackson, you know, Bob played me, he remixed the band's music from Big Pink.
Mm-hmm.
And Peter and him are good friends. And Peter said, you know, why don't you let, because he had a 4-track, you know, so he had mono drums, bass and guitar and this. And Peter split it out for him and he couldn't believe it's so good. But, it's hard. It's expensive. It's, very, very time consuming. You have to, you know, build yourself a model that is huge and, you know, get it's massively data intensive.
I was invited to EMI for a playback session of the Atmos version of Revolver, Beatles Revolver. It was narrated by Giles Martin.
Giles. So, he's a good friend of mine.
Well, Giles went through everything and that he was doing, but the one thing that really impressed me was there was, after one of the tracks, he said, yeah, so it was two guitars, bass, and drums on one track. And we were able to not only separate those all out, but also separate the kick and the snare out.
Right.
And then he played them. He played the extractions. And I was like, this is amazing. Are you kidding me?
Yeah, look, you know, kicks and snares are the pop music is quite a bit easier.
Yeah, well, yeah, sure, than splitting out a viola. I agree. Yeah.
Right. From a section. It's a different world, but yes, that's and I was actually at Abbey Road a few years back and we finished a project early, but we had the studio for a day and I was just pumping synth. Whenever I have time at Abbey Road, if I'm doing a project, I've been there quite a bit. I'll just have a day where I take synths and I pump them out into the room and get some organic goo around them a little bit so that I might not have to use reverb. And so I was having one of those days and, you know, I made a list and my poor assistant was stuck sitting there with the list. And, you know, I said, save the good stuff for me, you know, and just do this. And I'm walking around and Giles pops out of Studio 3. He says, what are you doing? I said, you know, I have this sort of day where I'm doing, you know, just cleanup work. And he goes, come on, hang out. And I come into Studio 3 and him and Sam are remixing While My Guitar Gently Weeps.
Yeah.
And with the Clapton guitar solo track on its own. And I mean, wow. What a way to make a living.
Yeah, right.
And they pay him to do that.
Yes, no kidding. I can see why, though. He's so personable. And
he's lovely.
Yeah, he's a lovely. Great guy, yeah.
As they would say in England, he has quite a bawdy sense of humor. I have a picture over there of his dad standing above me with me on my knees playing back a boys choir recording we did for the movie Prince of Egypt. And then next is a picture of me and him in Studio 3 at Abbey Road. So if this was a video podcast, I'd show it to you. But
Okay. Well, knowing that it's there is enough at this point. Okay, Alan, last question. And thanks so much for your time. I do appreciate it. I know you're a busy guy.
I appreciate you. And you know, I actually bought your book for my assistant because I'm like, you haven't had the opportunity to live this life, but here's the information. And it helped him out. I mean, he's just starting. It helped him out so much about where to place his speakers and how to think of his room and, you know, stuff like that. So I appreciate you quite a bit.
Well, thank you. And it's always nice to hear things like that. That's for sure. Okay. What's the best piece of advice that maybe somebody imparted to you or maybe you learned along the way?
In terms of, I mean, that's a hard question. Let me answer it. Let me answer it twice. Okay.
Yeah.
In terms of the technical world is do more with less. You want it to sound good. You don't need 5 mics on the guitar cabinet. You just get a better guitar sound and just put 2 if you want, put up a, you know, or 14 drum room mics or stuff, you know, try to do more with less. Really think about what you're putting up and what it's doing. And I think that would, and then the 20% rule, you know, just everything you think it should be, it's going to want to be a little less. And trust me, when you put it all together, that you're going to agree with me. So that would be it. But the bigger thing is, you know, I love my job. I love my work, but it's music. I'm not opening up people's chests and trying to fix their heart. Don't get yourself crazy. You know, they say that when people are older, they ask, well, what's the one piece of advice that older people always give that they said they could have given themselves as a kid? And they say, worry less. So I, you know, that's sort of my, you know, where I'm at the worry less stage of my life, where I wish I had been able to tell myself it's going to be okay, you know, and that's very important. And also only do this if you can't not do it. If you are so passionate about it, that it's not about making money, because this is a shitty way to make money. Okay. 9 out of 10 people who are in this industry end up being working in a semi-blue collar situation where they're working at a studio for 30 years and stuff like that. And it's a hard way to make you put a lot. You could become a neurosurgeon with the amount of time it takes you to get into this. So make sure that this is what you really want. And if it is, don't stop for anything.
Thanks for listening and being in my inner circle. Remember, if you have any questions or comments, you can send them to questions@bobbyosinski.com. You can also learn all about the latest in music, audio, and production news when you sign up for my newsletter at bobbyosinski.com. There you'll also find out about openings for my latest online classes and special events. That's bobbyosinski.com. To listen to other episodes of Bobby Osinski's Inner Circle, go to bobbyosinski.com and select the podcast tab, or go to bobbyoinnercircle.com, where you can find it on Apple Podcasts, Apple Music, Mixcloud, Google Podcasts, Spotify, Deezer, TuneIn Radio, Radio Public, and Podbean. At bobbyosinski.com and bobbyoinnercircle.com, you'll also find a sign-up form for my newsletter and for alerts for new podcasts. This is Bobby Osinski. I will see you next time.